The expectations we have for our medical care are very, very different from what they were in the early days of the American Republic. Nobody in their right mind would consent to surgery without any anesthesia, but that's how surgery was done well into the 19th century. And it was performed with instruments that were seldom cleaned, let alone sterilized. One young doctor did much to change all that. His name was Thomas Dent Mutter, and he is the subject of the book Dr. Mutter's Marvels. It's by Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, who's a nonfiction writer and poet born and raised in Philadelphia, where Dr. Mutter did most of his work. Her book on Mutter came out last year and is just out in paperback. Kristen, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey. It's great to be here.
Like a lot of great biographies, this one starts with the subject's death. Why did contemporaries think that Dr. Mutter would be forgotten?
He was largely forgotten. One of the things that made him so unique in his lifetime was that he sought out and invented surgeries for a population that was largely ignored in Mutter's own lifetime, and that was the severely deformed. They were medically categorized as monsters back then, just like idiot was a medical categorization. And, you know, plastic surgery or reconstructive surgery at a time before anesthesia was unheard of. You know, why would someone elect to have a surgery when they were awake if they didn't have to? So that population was ignored. Surgeries were not created for them or offered for them. And Mutter was one of America's first plastic surgeons and certainly the most ambitious in terms of who he sought out. And throughout his career, he was known as the one person who could do these amazing surgeries that would transform the faces and bodies of the severely deformed. But he had been sick his entire life. And when he was told that he would be dying within a few years, he realized that this reputation that he had built up as, you know, this wonder kind, this sole person who, you know, they used to write about, you know, people coming to his office to touch his garment, you know, to make themselves whole as if, you know, he was a Christ figure. And he adored that. He was a very vain man. He realized that this legacy he had built up would hurt the very people he had devoted his life to helping, that if he died and the community of doctors around him thought he was the only one who could do these surgeries, then no one would help these people. So the last few years of his life, he dissolved essentially what could have been a brilliant legacy to make sure that after his death, his students, his peers, his colleagues would continue to perform these surgeries that he was an expert at and help the population that had been ignored. So in a sense, he's the reason for his own, you know, history sort of forgetting him. But I was really thrilled to find his story, and I'm very happy to be bringing it back into light with Dr. Mutter's Marvels.
And it is pronounced Mutter, and he did add the umlauts over the U himself.
Right. No one actually knows how he pronounced his name. He was definitely born Tom Mutter. So if you pronounce Mutter, you know, that's not a problem. But when he went to Paris and learned about Operations Plastique, you know, what we know today as plastic surgery, and realized this was going to be his call of action. You know, he was going to bring this amazing new field to America. He decided to add a little flash to himself and added the umlaut to his name. And I'm from the position that when he added the umlaut, he also altered the pronunciation to sound a little more European. But to this day, even the Mutter Museum staff itself disagrees with how you'd pronounce his name.
Oh, that's funny. So anyway, he was born in 1811. So this, we're talking the early 19th century here, where surgery was, okay, go ahead and gross us out and tell us the kinds of things that happen in surgery.
It's my pleasure. Everyone should put down their bagels at this time.
Right.
Yeah, medicine was really a wild, wild west. You did not need to have a license or a medical degree to practice medicine in the early 1800s. You could literally just stick a shingle, you know, that says you're a doctor and begin, you know, bleeding people and leeching them, sticking leeches on the body to cure your body of sort of ill humors was very popular in early American medicine. But in surgery in particular, this was a time before ether anesthesia. So all of Mutter's patients prior to the invention of ether anesthesia in 1846, all of those surgeries were done while the patient was awake. And in fact, it was a common practice in that time period to hire men to literally hold the patient down on the surgical table. So that, you know, to keep the patient still during the surgery, sure, but mostly to keep the patient from standing up and running out of the room, which would be my instinct, I know, the moment that knife hit my flesh. But it was also a time before many of the modern amenities that we love, such as electricity. So all of these surgeries happened by candlelight or by sunlight or like mirrors reflecting into wounds. It was the time before germ theory was proven. So you didn't have doctors, who washed their hands prior to surgery. In fact, on Mutter's own faculty, Mutter was the chair of surgery, and he was fastidiously clean at a time when that was not at all normal, was considered, you know, an affectation and very effete. But Miggs, who was the chair of obstetrics at the same time, he spoke out against doctors washing their hands before surgery, which seems shocking by today's standards. But he said to insist that a doctor washed his hands was to say that, quote, doctors weren't gentlemen because all gentlemen were clean men. And this was the chair of obstetrics, literally the first, you know, his babies were coming into his hands and he was not even washing them before doing these procedures. It's no wonder why with that philosophy that, you know, one in every four women would die in childbirth within their lifetime, and the death rate for children was horrific. So few children survived the first year of their life because of practices like Miggs.
We're talking about Thomas Dent Mutter, who is the subject of the biography, Dr. Mutter's Marvels by Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz here on the Jefferson Exchange. So what got Mutter thinking that things should be different? I mean, what was his impulse to think that people might be asleep and hands might be clean?
Entire family died, and I mean entire family, grandparents, parents, siblings, before he turned the age of 8. And that was not really uncommon back in the early 19th century. You didn't have antibiotics, but even if you did, they didn't understand the communicable nature of diseases. So you would have something like yellow fever or cholera or even, you know, the flu come in and decimate, you know, entire families or sometimes entire neighborhoods of people. They just didn't understand how diseases were spread. And Mutter himself, though he survived the death of his entire family, was weakened and sickly throughout his entire life, but especially through his childhood and adolescence. And I think because he was the patient for so many years in the doctor-patient relationship, he was uniquely suited to understand what a patient deserved, what a patient craved to have happen, and what the difference, how he felt between a clean doctor and a filthy doctor. And he brought all of that knowledge with him into the operating room. And he had practices that put the patient in the center. He did a lot of preoperative care with his patients. Again, this is before either anesthesia, so he knew his patients would be awake during the surgery. And while many doctors at that time period, in fact, nearly all of them, chose to keep the patient in the dark about what would be happening to them, Mutter explained everything to them and made them a partnership in the surgery. But he also helped create what we now know as post-operative care. Prior to Mutter, you didn't have recovery rooms at surgical clinics, if you can believe that. You know, after they perform surgery, they would just sort of unceremoniously dump the patient into a wagon and ride them over the cobblestone streets of Philadelphia, which is unpleasant in a car where you're a rubber tire filled with air, let alone wooden wagon wheels, after you've had surgery. And Mutter thought this was ridiculous and insisted that recovery rooms, rooms where his patients could literally recover and he could make sure their wounds didn't get infected and deal with fevers, be built. And his home institution, Jefferson College, which is now Jefferson University in Philadelphia, refused. They literally didn't understand why it was necessary. And Mutter took it upon himself to rent out a floor above a local restaurant and would transport his patients there just so that he could give them the care he believed they deserved, you know, years before Jefferson would relent and create these rooms for him themselves.
Wow, very different kind of doctor for his time, the kind of guy you hope you'd have in our time. Thomas Dent Mutter is the subject of the biography, Dr. Mutter's Marvels by Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, now out in paperback. We will come back and talk more with Kristen about Dr. Mutter and take your comments and questions by phone and email if you'd like to join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Back in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking today about one of the 19th century's brighter lights in the field of medicine, Thomas Dent Mutter. He's the subject of the biography Dr. Mutter's Marvels by Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz. She's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She regales us with the story of how Dr. Mutter could actually imagine a time in which people were not awake during surgery, in which doctors did wash their hands and their instruments, and people had a chance to recover, all things that were rare in Dr. Mutter's time. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments, 800-838-3760 by phone or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We talked about Mutter being involved in medical training. He did certainly impress his medical students in addition to his patients with the level of care he was willing to give. How were doctors trained then, and how did he become part of the training?
You didn't need a license or degree to become a doctor, but medical schools were on the rise. You know, prior to that, you had apprenticeships or book learning, reading and learning from those around you. But when medical schools were created, they were actually founded in Philadelphia, University of Pennsylvania, the first medical school in America, founded by Ben Franklin. And Jefferson Medical College was created in response to it. Jefferson Medical College, where Mutter would later taught, had the revolutionary idea of surgical and medical clinics. Prior to that, doctors would lecture from a lectern in one direction, sort of explaining medical procedures verbally. Everyone, occasionally they would have an illustration to show. And then would end their class. These students would buy tickets for lecture series, and you would take tests to prove that you've learned what you learned, and typically took two rounds of lecture series in order to receive a degree because the ideas were so complex and being described to you only verbally. But Jefferson, founded by Dr. George McClellan, the father of Union General George McClellan, realized that the best way to teach medicine was to watch doctors interact with their patients, and created America's first medical and surgical clinics, where as a part of the class day, they would see patients come in and meet with the various doctors and see surgeries being performed in surgical theaters. And that really revolutionized how medicine was taught in that time period. Mutter joined as a chair of surgery at Jefferson at the early age of 31, the youngest member of that faculty by far, and began introducing these new and innovative surgeries that he had learned during his travels in Paris and Europe, as well as ones that he had created himself, which he, designed to help these this population of patients, what we spoke about before, the severely deformed, at a time when they weren't really being looked at as subjects of study. And some of the surgical techniques that he created and taught for the first time in front of these generations of doctors were so innovative and so forward-thinking that they're still being used today. When I talk to people about Dr. Mutter, frequently they've never heard of him before. He doesn't even have a Wikipedia page to this day.
Really?
But people might know about the museum, the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, the sort of cult museum of medical oddities. But if I speak to surgeons, they know the name Mutter from the Mutter flap surgery, which was one of the earliest forms of skin grafting that has ever done on American soil. And that started way back in the 1840s with Dr. Mutter.
Interesting. So he actually had a procedure name for him, but this is one of the things that he did that really put him ahead of his time. He was willing to do things that would use people's own tissue to make them whole again.
Absolutely. One of the more common deformities that happened during the 19th century. I mean, the book is filled with tons of illustrations, and all of the engravings of patients that you see in the book are Mutter's own patients. And you'll see deformities on women of burns. That was very common in the 19th century because you're talking about women who wore very sort of tight-fitting clothing made of flammable materials, and they worked in front of open flames. So it didn't take a lot, a children hugging her at the knee all of a sudden, or an ember rolling out, for these women to sort of be trapped in flames. So facial burns were very common for women, a common disfigurement, and no one knew how to fix it. I mean, frequently they were hidden because the family was so ashamed of having such a deformed woman in their family that they wouldn't even seek medical treatment, lest, word got out about this unfortunate incident. And Mutter devised a surgery, an early form of skin grafting, which involved transplanting skin from the back and simply twisting it, allowing a flap of skin to still stay attached to cover up the now cut out deformed skin. And by having that flap still there, it allowed blood and oxygen to go into that new skin and form a connection. And it allowed essentially early skin grafting at a time when that was seen as impossible. It also helped that Mutter was fastidiously clean in a time where that was not the norm. So many of his surgeries that were seemed impossible by other doctors were not because they were so technically innovative, but because because Mutter was clean and they were dirty. Infection was by far the largest killer of surgical patients, and a huge killer of any medical procedure. You know, for every one soldier that was killed in the battlefield in the Civil War, two more died of infection alone in hospitals. That's how bad the treatment of infections was back in the 19th century. So, you know, that Mutter was able to do these surgeries, invent these surgeries, and pull them off successfully because of his innate knowledge of what it was to be a clean and, you know, sanitary surgeon is why his success rates were, you know, heads above the statistics for other peers of his generation.
So certainly brilliant in seeing things that became standard in medicine just a few decades hence, but this would have made him suspect to the establishment. And I guess at this point we can talk about Charles Miggs again, because he was not the nicest guy in the world to Thomas Mutter.
You know, one of the struggles when I first began looking at turning the story into a book was that Mutter was so ahead of his time. You know, everything he does, you understand fundamentally as a modern person, that it was sort of hard to understand why there'd be a struggle against it. And I was so grateful to find a foil for his story with Charles D. Miggs. Charles D. Miggs was the leading voice of obstetrics during his lifetime and was the chair of obstetrics at the same college that Mutter was the chair of surgery. And they could not have disagreed more about everything. Mutter was, known as being, quote, painfully sympathetic with the plight of his patients. He would spend days, if not weeks, working with patients before surgeries and then days and weeks afterwards taking care of them. And he believed that they were equals in the act of surgery, especially because these surgeries were done while the patient was awake. Miggs, on the other hand, was the chair of obstetrics, right, in charge of teaching these male doctors, because it was illegal to teach a woman to be a doctor in that time period, how to treat women. And he would, from the lecture podium, say things like, women's heads are too small for intellect, but just the right size for love. and calling men the masters and lords of women. I mean, to teach contempt for your patient was not uncommon, was actually championed during Mutter's lifetime. When ether anesthesia was discovered in 1846, Mutter was the first surgeon in Philadelphia to hold a successful ether surgery. Within months, it would be banned in hospitals across the country, and it was because of opinions that were shared by doctors like Miggs. Miggs not only spoke out against the dangers of ether anesthesia, of robbing people of their senses to have surgery. I mean, he did no pain management for women in labor because he said the Bible says, in sorrow thou shalt bring forth children. So he thought it was against God to help women manage pain in labor, which seems sadistic by today's standards. Not only did he speak out against ether anesthesia, but he actually would bring in sheep into the classroom and etherize them to death just to prove how dangerous it was and discourage this generation of doctors from using it. I mean, by today's standards, it's insane, but it was a real debate. So much of what Dr. Mutter innately knew wouldn't be proven until decades after his death, when the tools such as the modern microscope were invented to prove, things like germ theory or the standardization of medicine, which didn't exist in Mutter's time, right? All of the medicines were sort of hand-created by apothecaries, and they're consistently, their consistencies differed according to who made it, when it was made, and what materials were available when they were making it. To be able to have ether standardized, would make it much, much safer than the dangerous, unstable chemical it was seen during Mutter's lifetime. So much, that Mutter thought would prove to be true, but unfortunately he died very young and didn't live long enough to see himself be proved right.
Kristen O'Keefe Aptewitz, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book about Thomas Dent Mutter is called Dr. Mutter's Marvels. You stopped a little short on the story about the sheep, because one of those went a little wrong for Dr. Miggs, I understand.
That's right. Famously, so he would bring in these sheep to kill them and then, get in front of the dead sheep and talk about, oh, imagine if this was, a woman, a laboring woman on your table and you killed her like this. Like, tears would come into his eye. Miggs was known as being a very theatrical professor and really using melodramatics to prove his point. So here he was, caught up in the emotion of his imagined story, when behind him he heard a And it turned out he had not used enough ether, and the sheep came back to life during his lecture, utterly disproving everything he was making such an impassioned plea for his students to believe. And that was one of, I remember reading that story in an archival library and just, falling on the floor nearly with laughter. The poor archivist came out and was like, "Are you okay?" But it was so rare during Miggs's lifetime, during his career, I should say, for him to be disproved. He was so stubborn. But that was what was popular in 19th century medicine. Again, before you had the tools to prove these things correctly, all doctors really had was their own firmly held opinions. And the firmer you held your opinion, the truer it had to be. And so they were very, very stubborn. And, Mütter did not live long enough to see that his ideas were proved right. But certainly the story of Miggs, which is told throughout Dr. Mütter's Marvels as well, he lived long enough to see himself be proved wrong. And it's just an interesting counterpoint to the life of Mütter to watch what happened to Miggs.
We talk in the book about how Mütter was a pretty snappy dresser, intended to match his suit to his carriage, things like that.
Yeah.
You mentioned, too, that he was quite fastidious, kept himself clean all the time. I mean, better than the gentleman of his day. But did you get the sense that he was boastful in any way?
Yes. Again, that was the 19th century time period. He believed very strongly that his opinions were correct, as many doctors did, and did not have a lot of patience for doctors who did not see, the approaching modernity of medicine, right? So if people didn't believe in ether anesthesia or didn't believe in washing their hands or tools, he was not shy about his expressing his opinions. And it actually was very difficult for him to establish himself. Quaker Philadelphia, of course, you have all these people dressed in browns and blacks, and here he is in blue silk suits swanning down the street, yelling at them that their ideas are antiquated. They were not having it. But luckily, the brilliance of his thought and philosophy and the skill that he had as a surgeon caused him to rise up the ranks despite people disliking the way that they thought, they thought he should just behave differently. Towards the end of their life, people really began to realize that as boastful as he was and outlandish as he was right. And he got to experience some of that during his lifetime, but, mostly it was after his death that so much of his philosophies would be proven right.
You mention in the introduction to the book that what got you down the track of looking into the life of Thomas Dent Mütter was visiting the Mütter Museum, I think, when you were in fourth grade. You could get the sense that he was kind of into creepy stuff. So tell us about what the collection is, because it sounds sort of like the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum.
Absolutely. Growing up in Philadelphia, it was, a rite of passage for school-aged children to visit this medical oddities museum where you would see, body parts in jars and women with horn growing from their heads and, conjoined twin skeletons. But back then you have to, again, so much of the book is understanding the 19th century perspective, which was so interesting. Early 19th century America was just the beginning of so much interesting ideas and philosophies, and especially in medicine. And back then, they didn't have photography. They obviously didn't have film. So if you came across an unusual thing in your medical practice, something that might only happen, twice or, a handful of times, you would want to preserve it somehow. And some people did illustrations, but if you could preserve the actual diseased limb or, soft tissue or create a perfect wax replica of this unusual deformity, you would do it, not only as a teaching tool. Mütter collected this a lot because he was a professor and taught students, so he wanted to give them a wide range of what to expect during their practices, but also because his specialty was cases that medicine largely ignored. So to rescue some of these unusual pathological specimens from sideshows or from bars where you would pay a dollar to see something disgusting in a jar, for him to examine them and think, if this was a patient that came across my practice, how would I have helped them, was extremely important to him.
He helped a lot of people, and I'll tell you something. As Kristen pointed out earlier, you want to put down your bagel when you're reading this book, because there are lots of illustrations. But the fact is that Thomas Mütter didn't turn away from these people. He turned to them and helped them, and that's a large message of the book. It is called Dr. Mütter's Marvels. Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz wrote it and joined us on The Exchange. Kristen, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.